Hello everyone. So let's begin today's seminar. Thanks a lot for coming. Today we have as guest Alessio Franci, who comes from the University of Liège in Belgium. And he will speak about how we describe with the dynamical system bifurcation theory some decision making that I think is a topic relevant to many of us. He was already around on Friday, and so many of you had the opportunity already to speak with him. The other good thing is that he will stay around also this afternoon and tomorrow. So if you find the links with your research in this talk, please come to me or directly to him, and there will be plenty of time to chat today and tomorrow. I will let him explain about his research. I will introduce him now on what he did before. So, as I said, he is a professor now in Liège, where he is building a lab on neuromorphic computing together with some colleagues there since 2 years, more or less. Am I right? Yeah. And however, he's Italian, and so he comes from studies in Pisa, where he did his master studies at the Normale of Pisa, and then moved for a PhD in Paris. And from there, he started exploring various centers. He did a postdoc in Liège, Cambridge, and then a long stay in Mexico, where he was professor and interacted a lot with Princeton, with Naomi. Many of you might know him, made many influential work with Ian, so another relevant topic related. So a lot of connection with our research, we believe. And so now he's, as said, in Belgium. We really look forward to this talk, because I think it can really create a lot of links with many of us, and we are curious to see and understand more about neuromorphic computing that I hope you will include in some of your slides, or anyway, there will be chance to chat and tell us more about it. So the stage is yours. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Giovanni. It's a really great pleasure to be here, and already Friday and this morning has already been a super exciting visit with a lot of fantastic discussion. I felt like already learned a lot during this day and a half, and many ideas, and I hope I will be able to give back something to you with this talk about what I'm learning. So my research has always touched both neuroscience and collective behavior in order to bring idea toward engineering, in particular control theory, to develop more efficient machines, essentially. And so I would like to start the talk from the neuroscience part. And in particular, I guess everybody here knows what a spike is, a neuronal spike, yes? So I think I would like to start from the question, what are spikes? What we know and what we don't know about those objects, and then I will get to the connection with decision making and how decision making might bring a new perspective on spikes, and also how to use them and understand them in modeling collective behavior and in engineering them. So it's pretty clear that if you lower an electrode in many beings, like a rat, you will find spike all over the places. And the spike can appear in various form and shapes. And these have been known since almost 100 years already. And this is true also across level of evolutionary stages. So if you also take C. elegans, maybe you don't have sodium spike, which are completely absent in the worm, but you have something that looks like a spike on longer time scale due to calcium oscillation, another type of slower electrical activity that still exhibit this kind of fast rising and then plateau for a while and then go away. So something that looks like a spike, but maybe it's lower in the worm as compared to ourself or a rat. And since the work of Hodgkin-Huxley and all the research that's been done in the last 60 years, we know a lot about the electrophysiology of spikes. So we know all the type of ionic currents that underlie the generation of action potential. The fact that if you want to tweak the spiking behavior, you have to change the expression of these ionic currents made through neuromodulators, neurotransmitter, drugs, and so on and so forth. And these allow essentially to understand how spikes are regulated, how they change in form and shapes depending on cell type, depending on context. But we are still very, very far from understanding how spikes are related to embodied cognition and behavior in the real world. And in particular, you can, through experiments, you can find correlates in spiking activity of decision making, of perception, of action. But really, having a theory of how spikes allows us to be so flexible in the real environment is still something that we are very far. And throughout the years, there has been many theory trying to explain why spikes are used in the first place. And so maybe during the 90s or 2000, there was a lot of work trying to understand spikes as units of information. So making the analogy that each spike corresponds to sending one bit of information, and then trying to use some information coding theory to explore spikes from an information theoretical perspective. That's a possibility. Another possibility is that spikes are essentially appears as necessary once the animal is too large. So in a sense, once you have an animal that's sufficiently long, you cannot really rely on molecular communication anymore to connect the different parts of the body of the system. And so you start to switch from molecular communication to electrical communication. And because you are communicating in such a dirty environment, you need to use strong signals. You cannot really use analog signals, so use these spikes, which had this kind of all or none property that allows to connect different parts of a body. Maybe they save energy, essentially because they allow to create sparse code. So using this temporal pattern, maybe they allow us to use, for group of cells, to use less signaling and less communication than if you were using continuous time signaling. We know that they're kind of needed for learning, because if you don't have spikes, then you don't have opening of calcium channel at the synapse. And if you don't open calcium channel at the synapse, then you are not really able to induce plasticity between cells. So you need spikes, for at least for what we know, you need them to trigger learning in neural networks. Something that for me remains still puzzling is that all of this theory are kind of a little bit piecemeal, in the sense that, okay, if I want to use any of this theory to actually use spikes in engineering context, I don't really have a receipt to engineer things or to understand spikes from a more theoretical and in particular control theoretical perspective. And the very simple point I would like to make in that probably spikes can be understood from already at the single cell level from a more cognitive and functional perspective using the decision-making approach. And in particular, what I will say is probably almost trivial. Each time you have a spike, you have, by definition, a threshold. And so each time you have a neuron that receives an input, in response to this input, each neuron is essentially making a decision, and the decision is to emit a spike or not. And this, of course, can happen at the time scale of milliseconds from fast neurons. It can happen at the scale of hundreds of milliseconds for slower neurons. And if you go in dendrites, you have NMDA spike, calcium spikes. So also in our neurons, which are relatively fast, you have kind of slow decision-making process that happens in the dendrite, and that solving this type of decision-making constantly, whether to switch to an active state in which you communicate, in which you activate molecular cascade inside the cell, or not. Okay, so if these, these I think really kind of makes a lot of sense in a sensory motor perspective, from a sensory motor perspective, in the sense that if you have a worm that has to decide whether to move back or forward as a function of sensory stimuli, well, probably it's receiving touch and somatosensory perception both at the tail and at the head, and probably both ends are stimulated, and still the worm has to decide whether to move backward or forward. And so it it has to integrate this noisy perception on the body to transform it in a motor decision. And it's, for me, it's kind of clear that if all of this is very analog, then the signal will be integrated in a way that's very hard to transform in a sharp decision. But if the worm wants to survive, it also to make decisions that are something, so decisions that can actually activate its behavior and not remaining in a uncertain state in which it doesn't know whether to move backward or forward. And so it makes sense to have all or none sensation and all or none action in such a way that the behavior is robust to uncertainty. So it can break deadlock, it can break indecision, and essentially between the two, you have very likely recurrent network that transform these all or none events at the sensation into all or none action at the response. And so in this perspective, spikes are not a unit of information. They're not something that's used to transmit information at all. In this context, you don't really need to talk about representation, about information transmission of information of any kind. You have a control system that wants to transform noisy sensation into a well-defined motor response. And in this setting, each spikes really makes a difference. And one might think that this is just related to simple organism, that if you go to the to the cortex, then you have millions of spike, and then the only thing that counts are the rate of the spike or some kind of macroscopic property of the spiking pattern. But this paper from Rodney Douglas, who's one of the neuroscientists that mostly, that since the beginning pushed a lot neuromorphic engineering as a way to understand the brain. In this paper, the point they make is that through inhibition and through gating, probably each spike in the cortex works essentially through something that generalized coincidence detection as a way to create a different pattern of activation function in the network space. And so each spike can literally let the network bifurcate toward different network state that eventually will generate behavior as a function of input. And for me, this makes a lot of sense, because if I think this network of neuron, it's not really natural to average across large population of neurons. It's not natural to average across time, but also in large scale networks like ours, it makes sense if each spike can actually make a difference in the state in which network fall. And this could happen for the thought you have, for the word you choose to say at each moment in this real-time decision-making process that we all live when we make tiny decisions like how to move our limb and which word to use in social interactions, or where to pay attention on, and so on and so forth. So the spirit here is really that if you think about the spikes as so excitable event, as something that has this very well-defined temporal marker that allows network to work just in time, and this just in time doesn't happen in any abstract time. This just in time happens in the in the physical time of the environment the body is working in. So using spike, you have something that works naturally as a synchronizer between computation and behavior, but only if you use single spike, not if you use rate of averaging across many spikes, because otherwise you lose temporal precision immediately. And moreover, each time you have a coincidence or this generalized coincidence detection mechanism, essentially you have a decision, and this decision can happen at various and many scales in a network like ours. So of course, my goal is not to understand cortical computation. I would be happy if I can understand how to use these in much simpler system and to engineer them for autonomous robotics, for instance, as a toy but very illustrative model of what eventually can scale up to large network like the cortex. And just to mention another, I will review. So this paper is quite old, and unfortunately almost forgot by more recent paper, but there has been a few papers that appear more recently that really goes in this direction. In particular, If you take a noisy population and the fact that this coincident detection can be seen, so this kind of common spiking that you need for you spikes as decision from a statistical perspective can be seen something bad because you need essentially to create correlation between spiking activity. But if instead of looking at things from the point of view of correlation, you look at things from the point of view of decision, in particular robust decision, where you realize that what they show in this paper is that having more correlated neural activity actually lead to more robust sensory motor perceptual decision making. Something that again goes in line with this idea are these two recent papers, one experimental and one modeling, where essentially they rediscover this idea of creating a rich pattern of electrical activity in network using essentially gating through single spikes. Okay, now that I finished kind of the motivation for neuroscience, I would like to use this insight for designing a decision-making system that actually exploit excitability to achieve the same flexibility that we see in animals, essentially. This is the plan for the next part of the talk. And all of this has been a joint work with Naomi in Princeton, Anastasia, who was Naomi's postdoc, and now Naomi's PhD student. Then she was in Washington, and she recently she will soon be in Cornell, I think. Rodolphe, with whom I was in Cambridge and in Liège, and now who is at KU Leuven, and Guillaume, who is a colleague in Liège. And with Naomi and Anastasia, I've mostly developed the theory about fast and flexible decision making, which is kind of the basis for getting toward excitability in a way that makes sense from the decision making perspective. And with them, I mostly study how to model from a control theory perspective excitable behavior, and in particular, neuromodulation, so the tunability that you get once you have a dynamical system like neurons. And so the point I would like to make is that excitability is almost a necessary behavior, is not a casual. So the fact that so many systems converge towards something that looks like excitable, excitability and spikes to interact with the environment is not just a case, it's just an example of convergent evolution, given the constraint of making decisions in very uncertain environment, which are also non stationary. So spikes have this nice nature of being both continuous, so highly tunable, but also countable. So you can literally they almost look like digital, although they are created by fully analog dynamics. And this is key for the speed and the robustness of decision at all levels, from sensation to action. And at the same time, this analog nature essentially allows the system to be super flexible. So if you try to implement this in a digital algorithm, you will necessarily lose part of the flexibility because you will need to add almost to hook up extra feature of the algorithm without having it popping out automatically from the nonlinear dynamics of the system. And at the same time, you remain in the physical world because you're analog. So you remain with the physical time, something that can naturally interact with sensors, for instance, which necessarily are analog and interface with the real world, and motors, which again lives in real time. And so using analog system gives a way to be naturally embodied and that in a sense the decision making perspective maybe provides a way to go beyond encoding theory of spikes, and so literally using each spike as a decision more than talking about rate, latency, information coding, and so on and so forth. Finally, the tool that I'm an expert in, that are feedback control theory and bifurcation theory, essentially give us tools through which design the system and understand them concretely without doing large-scale simulation, but really understanding the mathematics and the nonlinear dynamics of what we have under the hand. And this is key if you want to bring this idea, for instance, to industry, where we want a certificate, we want something certain about how the system will work when we plug them in a robot that, for instance, has to interact with humans. Okay, so I will make all this point in the mathematically simplest settings, so starting from a very low-dimensional dynamical system, and then show at the end how things generalize and scale up to large networks. So this is the main dynamical object with which we have worked for many years. It is just a leaky integrator, so B are the inputs, and this is just low pass filter, so you have this low, this leaky integrator dynamics that's at the basics, that's the linear part of the system. And then there is a saturation of linearity. For simplicity, I'm just using 10H, because mathematically it's a nice function, but it can be something more complicated if you implement it in your neural network of choice or in neuromorphic hardware. And this 10H has as argument a feedback loop of X on itself. So this minus dx is negative feedback of actually itself that gives rise to the low-pass filter property of the system. And on top, you have positive feedback. So you will be a positive parameter. And so you have negative feedback and positive feedback that coexist in the same circuit, in the same model. And to make the analogy with decision, the state variable here, x, we can call it, just to give it a name that's reminiscent of decision-making, let's call it an opinion. And so in our model, x larger than 0 will correspond to favoring option A. Being close to 0 or 0 means being neutral, and B smaller than 0 means favoring option B. This can be generalized to many more options, but just to explain things, I will use this kind of binary choice configuration, this binary choice case. And yeah, as I was saying, the first term corresponds to negative feedback of opinion itself. So it's something that tries to damp an opinion. If there are no inputs, there is nothing, then opinion will want to go toward neutral state. And this is what this negative feedback term is achieving. And positive feedback is a way of amplifying input. So if inputs start to be sufficiently important, that this self loop will try to amplify them and transform even tiny inputs in something that recalls like a sharp decision. And yeah, the last term are input from the environment, information about the task we want to solve, or can also model intrinsic bias that the cell or the agent might have in this context. So the key player here to achieve this tunability and to use this basic block as a nice tunable model for decision making is this parameter U, this kind of self-attention, self-input that the dynamics is putting on itself. And very basically, if you change U, you see, and so if you change U and for B equal to zero, compute the steady state of the system, you realize, so computing the steady state means intersecting the graph of 10H with the graph of, so 10H of UX with the graph of DX. And you realize that if U is smaller than D, you are in the blue case. And so you have only one equilibrium at the origin. This equilibrium is stable. When U grows larger, there is an error here. So this should be larger and this should be smaller. So when U is larger than D, then you have three intersection. And so you have three equilibria. The one at the origin now is unstable. And the two that are not at the origin are stable equilibria. So what you are seeing here is a pitchfork bifurcation in which the equilibrium at the origin loses stability as this positive feedback gain increases. And in particular, you have a bifurcation for U equal D that, if you pay attention, correspond exactly to balancing positive and negative feedback. So when at the origin this term and this term are perfectly balanced each other, then you are at a bifurcation. And something that I want to make clear from now is that if you linearize your system at the origin when U is equal to D, then the linearization is exactly the drift diffusion model. So the linearization, because both linear terms have the same slope, the linearization for U equal D is just X dot equal B. So at the origin and at the balance of positive and negative feedback, you have exactly the drift diffusion model, where B, of course, will have both a deterministic part plus a noise, plus all the uncertainty on information. And so I think this is key, because if you take the relative diffusion model, as if you see it as just a linearization, as the local behavior of a model that, as we will see, has a much more tunable and richer dynamics, then maybe this provides a way also to have a model that can be more naturally fit to data and in a way that's more interpretable, instead of adding bits and pieces to the relative diffusion model. Now we can start to use bifurcation theory to kind of understand better the behavior that we are looking at. And so if I summarize what we just said in a bifurcation diagram, then you have that a U equals star, the origin, because switching from stable to unstable, so unstable fixed point are given by, maybe the laser was would have been used, by dashed lines. And something that is key in the bifurcation approach is that you can very naturally see the effect of inputs. So the left plot is for zero inputs, so no information in favor of any, I can barely see it, anyway. So here is when no inputs favor any of the options, and here when the options are favoring option one, so corresponding to positive states. And close to bifurcation, you see that the effect of input is ultra sensitive. So because you have this zero gain value, even tiny inputs completely break the bifurcation behavior and give something that highly nonlinearly amplifies the effect of even tiny input. This is really the principle of the drift diffusion model, in which you have a lot of noise and even tiny inputs are amplified by the relative diffusion model in such a way that through times you can get to something that's always take the right choice. The important thing is that now, okay, locally you behave like that, but globally you have a linear behavior that's tunable and that will naturally allows us to make something that can naturally interact with the world in real time. And this is where we're going. So we can also look at the bifurcation diagram. So this is the bifurcation diagram from positive feedback gain to state. Now what we can do here is to look at the bifurcation diagram for fixed U, and this is U smaller than U star, this is U larger than U star. And the bifurcation parameter now are the input. And so what you realize is that when you are below bifurcation, your system is basically linearly sensitive to inputs, because you are moving your system around a stable equilibrium before bifurcation. And then when you cross bifurcation, your system become hysteretic. So you have a system that essentially has two possible attractors, one attractor for decision one, one attractor for decision two. And depending on input, you have both memory of the decision you made and switches between the two attractors. And so now if you imagine U to be a parameter that can be tuned as a function of context, you have something that can either be very slow in integrating the input and very conservative before making decision, or something that can essentially flip a coin. And if you start here also for zero input, you will either pick an attractor or the other. And something that if you already have input that pushed to an attractor will keep memory of this decision before switching to the other one if the inputs go sufficiently toward the other direction. As I was saying, close to bifurcation, you are ultra sensitive. And this is, so locally again, you have this nice feature of being equivalent to a DDM. But at the same time, as opposed to the DDM, you can keep on increasing the bifurcation parameter, and if needed, you can break deadlock automatically. So you have a model that allows you to flip a coin very rapidly, because now this equilibrium is unstable, and so you have something that very exponentially goes away from indecision and converge to a decision state. And this can be fundamental, for instance, if you want to avoid the person or an object is not really clear if you have to avoid it on the left or on the right, maybe you want just to flip a coin and make a decision, okay, instead of just going straight into the object. Okay, so this is just to stress again that I think I will repeat a little bit. Okay, so this is like to repeat what I say, that we have something that can, whose sensitivity can be nicely tuned. There is still a caveat here. So in a sense, we would like, so if we're in a real setting and inputs in favor of the opinion are weak, then maybe we want to stay in this regime because we don't really want to commit to options that are not really clear. But now if the input intensity, so if the amount of certainty about the two options is increasing, then maybe we want something that switches from this behavior to this behavior in such a way that we can pick the correct, we can actually make a decision and be clear about what we are perceiving, what we want to do in terms of motor action. And so how do we achieve something that can, in a sense, automatically switch from this behavior to this behavior as a function of context? So something that for small input can remain close to initial and keep on integrating information, but that for larger enough input can rapidly and robustly commit to certain decision. And where this notion of small or large are defined by a threshold, and this threshold should also be a tunable parameter of your system, depending on some other certainty that you might have about the environment. And so this fact that you want both the threshold and the sensitivity of the system to remain completely tunable in a continuous analog fashion for your system to be actually flexible. So just to make a schematic of what you want is a system that can slide literally along this bifurcation diagram as a function of input. So this is the desired behavior for small input where things are too uncertain, but that can, as input B increases, can naturally cross bifurcation alone without us cranking up U and let the system converge to other of the two decisions. And if we use feedback theory, the idea is that we can add a feedback loop from X to U. So now U is not a parameter anymore. We give a dynamics to U in such a way that U can react to X. And if you do this, then imagine you have inputs that arrive. So if an input arrives, if it's positive, X will grow positive. If it's negative, it will go negative. But in both cases, the square of X will increase. And so as the square of X increases, now U is increasing as well. And if U increasing as well, then the positive feedback gain increases, and this amplifies the effect of input. And so each time you have this kind of positive feedback, you always know that you will get a point of instability. When the feedback is sufficiently strong, then you will have a switch. Again, you will have a change of behavior that's related to a bifurcation again. And indeed, if you consider U to, so now your new parameter is U0, which is kind of a Basel positive feedback, and you have a tunable gain that tunes how strong is the positive feedback interaction between X and U. The behavior of the system for, this is for U0 equals 0.75. What I'm showing here is the phase plane. So now we have a two-dimensional system, which is this one. And what I'm showing is the phase plane of the system. So you see that so the pitch for bifurcation now become the null cline of the fast dynamics. If you plot in the UX plane, you realize that the, let me go back. So the null cline of the X variable, so setting this line equal to 0, you have exactly essentially a pitchfork where U now is not a bifurcation parameter, but it works like a bifurcation parameter. So the pitchfork of the previous line now become the null cline of this variable. And then the null cline of this variable is just a parabola. If you put U in the x-axis like I'm doing, and so U in the abscissa and X in the ordinate, then you just have a parabola, but oriented horizontally. And these are the two null clines we are looking at in this phase plane. So you have on gray the null cline of the U variable, and on black you have the unfolded pitchfork because there are non-zero inputs, so B is equal to 0.035. And so what happens is that for a small input, you still have a stable equilibrium here in the phase plane. So inputs arrive, the opinion doesn't really stay at zero because you have a little bit of input that is exciting the system, but it doesn't switch to a high level because the positive feedback between the two is still not large enough to make this system, this low opinion equilibrium disappear. And as increase the input, what's going on is that the pitchfork is sliding to the left. And so as the pitchfork slides to the left, you lose the intersection here. So you don't have an equilibrium here for a small opinion anymore. And so you have this kind of switch to a very large opinion state for sufficiently large input. So now you have a system that can react more or less linearly or conservatively for small input, or switch to a large decision state when the inputs are large enough. And what's the threshold for this change of behavior? Well, this will be tuned by U0, because U0, what it's doing is moving the parabola left and right. And so if you increase U0, then what you're doing is moving this parabola to the right. And so for larger U0, for instance, 0.95, the same small input of 0.035, which was not enough to switch to a large opinion in this case, now is enough to switch to a larger opinion. So you have this extra parameter U0 that allows you to tune the sensitivity to input and maybe adapt it if you have some learning process, something in which you are keep on getting more and more confident about the environment, then maybe you want to switch from this behavior to this behavior and be able to make faster and faster decision as you receive information. And again, we can summarize all of this with a bunch of bifurcation diagrams. So now from when we use U0 as bifurcation parameter, what basically the main difference is that instead of having a supercritical pitchfork, now we have a supercritical pitchfork. And so we have coexistence of a stable equilibrium here, which corresponds to neutral stance, with two stable equilibrium here, which corresponds commitment to decision one or decision two. And when you have non-zero input, again, you have a neutral sensitive behavior here. But now, once you are in this state, then you will see a much larger jump in opinion. So a commitment which is much stronger as compared to the supercritical case. And if we put all of this together in terms of the bifurcation diagram, with respect to B. So what I'm doing here, so I'm using the color code. So this side here corresponds to the behavior in this regime. Then blue corresponds to what you have in this regime, and green what you have in this regime, and purple when you are in the bistable regime. And so if you look at how the input-output function of the system, so how X react to input, as this steady state transfer function is deformed as you change U0, you have a smooth transition between a basically linear sensitivity state to a state in which the linear sensitivity region remains here, but you also have a much more committed behavior when inputs are large enough positive or large enough negative. And as you increase U0, the linear sensitivity region becomes smaller and smaller, until you become bistable, and so here corresponds to flipping a coin. So this smooth so the possibility of tuning sensitivity in such a smooth fashion is only possible if you remain in the analog regime. As soon as you try to hook up a hybrid system or digital system to implement the same, you will probably lose some of it, or you will have to re-add it by hand. And I think this is the main advantages of using dynamical systems and continuous time dynamical systems and feedback theory to model these behaviors. There is another caveat, which is, okay, imagine, let me go directly to the figure to be slightly faster. So imagine you have made a decision and so your environment tells you make decision one. So now you have made a decision, for instance, turn left. Once you've made a decision to turn left, then maybe you want to be able to check again the environment and maybe update your decision as a function of what's going on. Imagine you're avoiding an obstacle, another person, and you have the impression that the person is going left, so you decide to avoid them on the right, but then the other person remembered that they have to go to the restroom, and so they change the direction, and now they go toward the left. You want to be able to very rapidly update your decision in order not to bump into them. And so the question is, okay, after we've made a decision, how do we forget this decision, and this is where spikes emerge. So what we want essentially is a system that makes a decision and that repolarizes, or a system that makes a decision and then go back to a neutral state in order to be able to become sensitive to the environment again and make a new decision. And okay, the analogy is really through, so it's where in this model we can take inspiration from neuroscience, and on top of this positive feedback, which essentially creates the spike, we can add slow negative feedback that ends the spike. This is really how neuronal spikes also work. You have sodium current or calcium current that create this regenerative spike upstroke, and then you have delayed rectifier potassium current or calcium activated potassium current that end the spike or the burst. And so here we are doing the same thing, but in the option space, in a space in which this variable X is not a voltage anymore, but is something that encodes for decision in a multidimensional option space. And when you do this, you have something like this excitable obstacle avoidance, in which if you have a unicycle that perceives an object coming to it, very rapidly can make spikes in the steering space in order to avoid the obstacle, in this case on the right. And if the obstacle was changing direction, then thanks to making a spike to the left, then maybe you can make a train of spike to the right and rapidly change your sensory motor behavior. If you don't use spike and you just use decision making, then what you risk is to have compulsive decision making. So you decide to go to the left, and although it's not a good idea to go to the left because the obstacle, maybe it's going, it's already on your right. Because you're stuck in this decision, then you might be stuck in turning to the left, and so have something that loop in the decision space, and this could lead, for instance, to collision in an obstacle avoidance context. So the takeaways from this is that if you look at spikes in the option space, then spikes might have naturally emerged in nature and in system that in embodied behavior in general as a way to have fast and flexible decision making, and a way of resetting decision and make new decision each time it's needed. And that if you get rid of the excitable nature, then it's very natural, very easy. So if you get rid of this analog reset of the spike, then it's very easy to get stuck in decision and have this kind of compulsive decision making. And that the continuous nature of the system is key if you want something that's continuously flexible, something on which we can use all the tools from bifurcation theory and feedback control theory to understand what is going on without essentially add pieces to models in a way that probably we won't have a theory to really understand. Yes, I mean, it's a far stretch, particularly for biologists, I guess, that this is what might have gone on in evolution. I think it's at least another option to be taken into consideration, that essentially spikes emerged by satisfying all these constraints. So to be fast, flexible, adaptive to changes in the environment, and tunable, so adaptive. Just a caveat for biologists, because nobody ever saw up and down spikes like I'm saying here, like I'm showing here. But so for me, these ups and down spikes are just a lumped model of our neuronal circuit. So of course, if you want to find this kind of behavior in circuit, you will never see neurons that do up and down spikes. But essentially, this model is a lumped model for two neurons, maybe mutual inhibition. And thanks to mutual inhibition, only when one neuron spikes, the other doesn't do anything. And so basically, up spike corresponds to spike of neuron one, and vice versa for spike of neuron two. So these excitable decision-making model have to be seen as a lumped or reduced model for potentially larger neuronal circuit in practice. And the same is true for neuromorphic engineering. So when we want to implement this on chip, it might be convenient to use this approach or that approach, but the mathematics of these guides, how you design the circuit and this model and how you tune the parameters. I think with my students, we are trying to do this, to use that approach because it seems to also use less transistor, but maybe slightly higher currents. I just want to say that the same model scale up to large networks. So everything I've seen was for one system making decision about two options. But if now, if you have many agents indexed by I making decision about many options, then you can have the exactly the same model with exactly the same ingredients that scale up to network. And in this case, what you get is essentially this fast and flexible and excitable decision-making behavior, but at the network level. And so what I'm showing here is the response of this network of agents deciding about two options. So like in the single agent case, interconnected through positive interactions. And the yellow part is where inputs are presented to the network and some nodes are receiving inputs in favor of option two. Some nodes are receiving inputs in favor of option one. But because the interaction is positive, the system naturally wants to converge to a consensus state. And so after the inputs are presented, there is a little bit of computation going on, and eventually the whole network converge to a global state in favor of option one. And because of excitable behavior, because of this negative feedback, after a decision has been made, it is forgotten and the system goes back to the neutral state. And so in a sense, this spike at the network level can be seen as a working memory, as a model for working memory in what we see, for instance, in the prefrontal cortex or larger networks of neurons. And the nice thing is that if now we switch the sign of the interaction, instead of taking positive edges between the neuron, we take negative edges, then after the inputs have been presented, the system converged to a cluster state in which some neurons or some agents maintain a decision for option two, some agents for option one, and some agents remain neutral. And these, for instance, might be used for task allocation. So you have inputs that tells you which agents should be allocated to task one or task two. And so this system, this model is a natural way of allocating the agent to those tasks, do the task for a while, and then go back to a sensitive state in which an update of the task allocation regime can be updated. And so what we are going to wire to is this form of generalized excitability or generalized spikes. For instance, here is a three nodes model with three inputs that have a six option dimension space. If you look, so these are the inputs to the three nodes. And as you can see, independently of the magnitude of the inputs, the system spikes positively for the largest input and negatively for the smallest input and remain neutral for the inputs that's in between. So this is a way that does kind of input comparison through spikes. And of course, three inputs, you have six options in terms of which input is largest and which input is smallest. And I'm almost finished. So in terms of application, this is connected to what we are doing in Liège. So one student is realizing this in sub-threshold CMOS hardware using 180 nanometer because it's cheaper, but the technology is also, so the design is also compatible to smaller, to more recent technology like 22 nanometers. So this is really a proof of concept that we can realize this type of flexible spiking behavior in analog, in sub-threshold CMOS hardware. Thanks to the theory, this is robust to mismatch, is robust to noise, and essentially the chip works. Then a student is using this type of ideas for developing an excitable decision-making layer to filter the events of an event-based camera. If you don't know what's an event-based camera, then I will be happy to discuss over the next, this afternoon or tomorrow. But it's for sure one of the main results of neuromorphic engineering. They work super, they're super powerful in many contexts in which standard camera just fails or impossible to use. Two students are working. So this is like the sensory aspect, this is the motor aspect. So the idea is to make excitable decision in the motor synergy space in order to be able to actuate more or less flexible structure through excitable decision making. And then a collaboration that I brought back from UNAMIS Mexico is with a group of Roman Rossi, where they do cognitive electrophysiology. And so we are trying to explore all this idea to understand what's happening across cortices in the during perceptual decision making in primates. With Naomi in Princeton, a student is exploring this to actually achieve robust navigation and robust robot-human interaction. For instance, for a robot that have to go from a target A to target B and avoid people in the middle. Another application is to use decision making, but in the space of games. So essentially, if you in this condition, these two cars essentially have two possible games to be solved. One is, do I go later or after if we take the same same lane? Which lane do I take if we take the same lane? And so these are the two possible variants, and this is the other variant for this game. So essentially, you can use opinion dynamics to robustly force one of these games in order to make the system, again, flexible and fast in changing the behavior. And things work very, very well. Not an expert in game theory, but the results are really shows that this flexibility and speed makes the system more reactive and more robust in this context. And then something that I'm here to discuss with a lot of you, in particular with Ian and Giovanni, is, okay, so we have this fast and flexible dynamics at the single agent case in a multi-option and collective behavior context. And now what happens if the interconnection between the agents is not continuous time like in the model I showed before, but actually the only thing that's communicated between the agents are events. And this is fundamental because communication is costly, is dangerous, takes attentional resources, takes computational resources. So both in a biological setting and in an engineering setting, it makes a lot of sense to have a kind of rich, nonlinear, continuous time dynamics inside the agents, but then only communicate seldomly in time when you want to communicate, when you want to interact with the others. And there might be a way to test this, maybe in the virtual reality setting, maybe using robotics implementation. So there might be things to explore in this in this direction. So that's all from my part. These are just some of the references I mentioned, both from me and collaborators, and other of the one I mentioned during the talk. And thanks a lot for the attention.
Thank you, Alessio. And there is some time for questions, and I'm happy to give the mic to anybody.
I really loved your starting introduction, got me thinking. And I would like to ask you again about the concept of spikes and how you defined them. So, and correct me if I give like misrepresent this, but my understanding is that your definition of spikes doesn't just include these extremely amplified raises in membrane potentials that we normally call action potentials, but anything that kind of increases and decreases again, so you could set a threshold. So it would include what we like typically would label like graded potentials or more the more analog kind of signaling. And then my next question would be, to play devil's advocate, what else is there? Are you making a definition of spikes that essentially includes any changes in membrane potentials that cells do? And then it kind of course, then it fits very well with the theory, but where do you kind of draw the line? So what's not a spike in neuron signaling or neural responses, yeah, to put it like that?
I think it's a super important point, because otherwise everything can be a spike or not. And my take on this is the flexibility aspect. So indeed, what defines a spike for me is the underlying feedback motifs. So each time you have something that at a certain scale, both in time or in space, if you go to specially extended systems, so that at a given scale has something that looks a positive feedback loop that serves as the amplifier, something that can create a threshold. In parallel with, so this could be at fast time scale or a short spatial scale. So this could be like calcium or sodium current in terms of fast or local excitation if you go to neural fields, in parallel with something that provides negative feedback at slower scale or longer spatial scale if you have a notional space. So each time we have this feedback structure, I think we can name this a spiky system. And then what will determine whether the system is mostly analog or mostly digital, or mostly spike in the real sense, is basically the balance of between these two. And I think something that has not been exploited enough, both in terms of understanding neurons and in implement these ideas in machines, is really exploring this balance. So for instance, if you go to dendrites, then in dendrites you have some, I mean, even if remaining cortex, in dendrites you have something that looks as spikes, but they can be more or less graded. And so this idea that dendrites are already doing some form of spiky computation, so extremely nonlinear computation, they're not just adding inputs, but they're already using this kind of switches and decision before reaching the SOM and before reaching the actual spike, I think it's something that is becoming more and more evident. Yes, so I would say that the feedback structure is what defines if a system is spiky or not. And then depending on cell type, neuron type, parts of the neuron, which type of biological system, you can have something that's really all or none and super prototypical and always the same, or something that starts to have a more graded nature. So for instance, if you try to use this for understanding cortical dynamics at a larger scale, for instance, for working memory, we already know that in the cortex, there are both evidences of categorical working memory, so something like an all or none spike, but in the network dynamics to retain memory very digitally. But we also have graded working memory, so something that switches on, but also retain a little bit of the quantity that generated the spike. My experience is that if we use this feedback approach, then it's kind of not, and bifurcation theory, it's kind of natural to use these gains as the tuner of this possible behavior and move from one word to the other.
And maybe just a comment or something that might be interesting in that context. In insects, there are systems, so for example, in fruit flies, and Katrin can correct me if I get this wrong, especially in the visual processing, so in Drosophila, the super tiny ones, there's a lot of graded potentials that essentially do the same computations that in big flies are done by spiking neurons, or in other big insects are done by spiking neurons. So that could be an interesting system to actually compare kind of the role of spikes in the classical sense and the all or none versus the more graded potential aspects.
Thanks.
Nice. Yeah.
Going to a higher, like, I was thinking how you would have to scale up to come with more complex behavior. And there I was wondering how you treat chaos or emergent behavior at the edge, for instance. So where do you see that non-linearities lead kind of to emergent behavior?
So I would say from an engineering perspective, at least, the goal is to stay away from chaos. Because then things become very intractable or difficult to tune and use for behavior. So something that we still did not really explore enough, particularly in collaboration with Roman, is, okay, when we go to really high dimensional networks, where is all this going, in a sense? Because if you look from in a very not naive, but of course, it, sufficiently high-dimensional dynamics will always look chaotic. If you just look at the temporal traces, they look like they're going all over the places. And something that we're learning through dimensionality reduction techniques, mostly principal component analysis, the mixed principal component analysis, is that this type of dynamics pops out in subspaces of the network space. So maybe the whole network is in some attractor state that looks more or less chaotic, but actually, if you project the networks in specific subspaces that one can understand as readout spaces of the network, then what emerges is already much more deterministic. And so maybe, what can go on is that this seemingly chaotic dynamic is just the superposition of many of these deterministic dynamics, because of course the prefrontal cortex is not only doing perceptual decision making in the somatosensory system. So it's the monkey is doing this the task, but it's also keep on being aware of its environment and doing all the process that PFC do all the time. And so maybe if we take a superposition of enough of these dynamics, then the network look chaotic at the large scale, but actually on specific fast spaces, it's much more deterministic. And then, yeah.
So we might have one further question, but then I guess people is starting to get hungry, so we might keep the conversation for later.
I think this follows on from the previous question. Which is related to, I mean, one of the reasons we think these types of systems should exhibit bifurcations is due to the ultrasensitivity near the bifurcation point. And I noticed on the slide that you jumped through because of shortage of time, you had the word ultrasensitivity, or I think I saw the word ultrasensitivity. So in terms of this emergent properties that were referred to in the previous question, can you comment on how adding this this additional tuning that allows you to have this neutral phase to sort of slide back and forth, how does this impact the ability for the system to benefit from emergent ultrasensitivity near the critical point?
The goal is really to be able to go back to the state, so that if you are close to an ultrasensitive state, but then you also want to make actual decision, so at a certain point converge to something that looks like an attractor that corresponds to trigger motor reaction, for instance. Then what you want to do is, okay, I switch to this non-sensitive state because I'm in a attractor regime. Then I want to go back to the ultrasensitive state. So excitability also if you take a neuron close to the rho base, what you see is really noise. So noise-driven amplified oscillation, and from time to time a spike. And then the system goes back to this ultrasensitive state. So that of course is a single cell, it's current clamp in a completely controlled condition. But I think this could be what's going on with spikes. So you exploit ultrasensitivity to amplify signals, but then you also want to do the actual something, not always just jitter around in ultrasensitive state, but actually have a motor response or something that allows you to escape from a predator or whatever. And so this is the motor response, is the sharp, that is the behavior. And after the behavior has been made, go back to the ultrasensitive state to again integrate the environment in this rich fashion. And something that also happened in the brain a lot is the fact of switching between, so on larger scale, switching between ultrasensitive regime like this one, in which you have tiny input generating spikes and so on and so forth, and much more endogenous regime, which connects back to also what we discussed this morning. So when we sleep or when we are in low attention state, then neuron switches from tonic spiking to bursting. And in bursting behavior, neuron synchronizes much more and they become essentially insensitive to inputs. This is really a rhythmic attractor state in which we filter our sensory input. And the network is in a very loopy state. Now, why this is useful for the brain is still debated, but for sure the possibility of switching between ultra-sensitive to fully endogenous state is also something that is captured by this tunable balance, essentially.
Thank you.
Great. So I think we can keep the discussion continuing this afternoon. Will be around between ZT and Z, so contact me or directly him if you want to meet. And another thing is this evening we will go out for a dinner. So if you want to chat over a beer or over a meal, please get in touch with me this afternoon. I'll book something probably on the river, the Constanzer Weinhaus. I don't know, remember the name, but yeah, Wursthaus. Okay. That's everything. Thanks for coming, and let's thank again the speaker.
Thank you.